Welcome once again to our program, our 19th in a series on the Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're talking about particularly the roots and the conclusions of this book that was so famous throughout our country and even across the world, but that his conclusions were so devastating and, from a Catholic viewpoint, so unfounded and unhistorical and so such an antithesis to the truth, that we've been trying to show that this book has terribly dangerous conclusions, even though it was a great mystery thriller for many, many people. But the conclusions are devastating to the Christian faith and, of course, the Catholic faith in particular. My guest is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High, teacher in church history, American history, world history, government, and religion. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus here at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar. Ron, the roots of the Da Vinci Code go deep into the Gnostic writings. And we've been talking about that, but we come specifically now to the meaning of Gnosticism, and just say a word in the beginning about the word Gnostic. We use it all the time. What is its origin, Gnostic?
Well, it comes from Gnosis, the Greek word Gnosis, which means knowledge, and it's usually associated with secret knowledge. So that's usually what's meant by Gnosticism. And Dan Brown relies very heavily. One of his main sources, of course, was Elaine Pagel's book, The Gnostic Gospels. I think to understand not only the Da Vinci Code, but all of this, all these programs have been coming out here lately, and all these books about the Gnostic Gospels, that you really have to have some understanding of what Gnostic means and Gnosticism means. And so that's why we're going to explain that today.
All right. Please begin explaining the meaning of Gnosticism, which we've talked about in every part of the program so far, because its roots are at the Da Vinci Code roots.
Well, there has been considerable debate among scholars as to the best way to generally describe the system of the ancient system of Gnosticism. The problem is that there are so many different varieties that it's difficult to arrive at an explanation that will account for all of the systems. You know, we mentioned in some of our earlier discussions, you know, the Valentinian and the Basilidian and the Marcion and others. Nonetheless, there does exist several elements that appear to exist in most popular ancient Gnostic system. This is the Syrian-Egyptian brand of Gnosticism was the most dominant. So that's the one, for the most part, we're going to discuss. And now, to begin our discussion of the elements of Gnostic mythology, as we could call it, at the top of the Syrian or the Egyptian Gnostic divinity was a remote, supreme, and unknowable monadic divinity called the Monad. That's a term that they a lot of times would use, meaning the one, or the absolute, or the perfect, and other such names. Now this God, this monad, is the high source of the pleroma. Now there's just a few words. We won't have too many. We'll have a few words here. The pleroma, the region of light, and is the parent of the universe. So there's two words here so far. We've got the monad, which is this good God, you might say. The number one God.
Okay.
That's what it means, monad. It means one. And he is the source of the light, all the of the light. That's a big word used in Gnosticism, the idea of the light. Another word for that is the pleroma. Pleroma, the region of light, and he's also the parent of the universe. Some traditions also call this monad the first eon. That's spelled A-E-O-N. People will see that, when you, particularly if you look into New Age writings, the eon, meaning forever or for eternity. So that's where we start. There's this monad. And this monad is the source of the universe. He's the source of all light, known as the Pleroma.
And he's a good God.
He's a good God. You know, we said that several times during our session that Gnosticism is dualistic. In other words, it's the idea that there's at least two gods.
One good and one bad.
Yes. Okay, from this monadic divinity, this monad, emanated a lesser divine being, beings or eons. So you have this monad, and from this monad sort of processes from or is begotten by or somehow emanated from. This is all mysterious, you know,
okay.
Kind of thing. We can't get very much more concrete with it. And by emanation, I mean they flowed from, they proceeded from, or they originated from this divine being, this monad.
Okay.
And these lesser divine emanations that proceed from the monad usually do so in pairs, male and female pairs. Now you can see how this is going to fit into the idea of the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine that you see, you know, so prevalent in the Da Vinci Code. They have the same nature as the monadal divinity, but they're less perfect. They're less perfect than the monad because they come from him.
Okay.
Because the monad is the source of all being. Now, taken together, the monad and the eons make up the Pleroma, or the fullness of God. It's a symbolic abstraction of the divine nature. Now, the imperfection of the lesser gods sets the stage for the fall, though. Now, we're not thinking of Adam and Eve's fall. This is the Gnostic idea.
This is the mythology,
yeah,
of Gnosticism.
This is the Gnostic, yes, mythology of the fall.
Okay.
This means that according to Gnostic mythology, the cause of the fall is found within the divinity itself, and not from some act of humans themselves, such as original sin of Adam and Eve.
So a completely essential and fundamental difference, as much as difference as night and day.
Yes. Now, this stage in the divine emanation is usually brought about through the recurrent Gnostic figure of Sophia. You see the name Sophia a lot, of course, in the New Age and what have you. Sophia, of course, is a Greek word meaning wisdom. And who in the Gnostic tradition is the final and lowest emanation of God. In other words, out of this monad is all these emanations. And you get down to the very lowest emanation, so to speak, the lowest God, so to speak, you get down to Sophia.
So they are gods.
They are gods, yes, but they're lesser gods.
Lesser gods, okay.
Of the same nature, but of the monad, but nonetheless of a lesser being, at a lower level.
Okay.
Because they originated from him.
Okay.
Now, some Gnostic traditions consider Sophia and her male counterpart to be Christ as the lowest emanation. And according to some Gnostic sources, Sophia desired to create something apart from the divine totality, and without the divine assent or agreement. And another source, Gnostic source, attributes her fall to an attempt to emanate on her own without the male counterpart, without Christ, in other words. Now, this is the Gnostic version of the fall. Not, again, a man and a woman disobeying God, you know, by partaking from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. These are gods who were really causing this. In other words, the fall comes within the Godhead itself. But these are lesser gods. These are the gods at the very lowest level of emanation. And the very lowest level was believed, at least in some Gnostic mythology, was Sophia, that is wisdom, and her you might say her counterpart, her male counterpart, Christ. Now, losing the light of the one, the divine monad, caused her a lot of fear and caused her a lot of anguish. And this resulted in confusion and a longing to return to the light of the one, you know, that is, the monad. Now, as a consequence of her separate creative act, in other words, if you follow that strain of the Gnosticism where she went ahead and created something without, you know, the monad's permission, so to speak, as a consequence of her separate creative act, she gave birth to a monstrous lion-faced demiurge. This is a god, in other words.
Okay.
A demiurge. D-E-M-I-U-R-G-E. You'll see that word an awfully lot in Gnostic writings.
Demiurge. Okay.
And being ashamed of her deed, she wrapped him in a cloud and created a throne for him within this cloud. Now, this demiurge was isolated. He had no knowledge of his mother or of any other beings. So being ignorant of the superior levels of reality, that is, you know, that whole pleroma, where, you know, the monad and all the aeons and everything, and where light was at, he's completely cut off from that. He's ignorant of this superior level of reality that were his birthplace. And having lost the light of the one, the divine monad, he concluded that he was the only being in existence. And in some Gnostic versions, the demiurge is equated with Satan. Some Gnostics equated it with the creator God of the Old Testament, Hebrews, Yahweh. This is particularly true of the heretic Marcion. Now, some versions of Gnosticism use the term archon to refer to the several servants of the demiurge. In other words, we would call them demons.
Mm.
And some people would equate, some Gnostics equated the demiurge, you know, with Satan.
Okay.
As we said, others with Yahweh, the God of the Jews in the Old Testament.
A real put-down to the Jews.
Oh, yes, certainly. And so these archons, in a sense, as I said, played sort of the role of angels or fallen angels, demons, that we find in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. Now, having unknowingly stolen some of his mother's power, the demiurge set out to create the physical universe and the physical aspect of humankind, that is, the body. The spiritual element of humans, the soul, was entrapped within the material body and the material universe. So here we have basically a material existence that's created by the demiurge, which is essentially looked upon as evil or bad. But the soul, the spirit, was created by the monad. And so somehow Sophia was able to infuse some spiritual spark into her son's human creatures. In other words, a soul. This is all kind of mysterious in the part of that mythology.
So it's really easy to get lost in the quicksand of this mythology.
Yes, what you end up having here is that souls, which are good, that come from the spark, the spiritual spark of the monad, Sophia infuses this spark into these human creatures, these bodies created by the demiurge. And so the soul is good, but the body is bad or evil.
Okay, and that continues down through history, rising and rising and rising again. And the church always tries to counteract that by saying the body is not bad.
This form of Gnosticism has raised its ugly head many, many times. Certainly we mentioned the Albigensians and the Cathars of the 13th century, who St. Dominic was able to go and win many of them back to Christianity.
And they had such beliefs as the body is bad, that suicide would be good because I free myself from the body. Marriage is bad because it's engaging in physical relations. So it continues to occur over and over again. And we think that, well, these ideas are so strange to us as Christians, particularly as Catholics, that they wouldn't have any influence except in these ancient times. But they keep recurring, recurring, recurring.
This Gnostic version sees the material world as evil and serves as a prison for its inhabitants, that is, for the soul. In this version, the material world is evil, but the spiritual world, including the human soul, is good. And in such a system, salvation is a matter of the soul escaping the evil material body. Somehow, mysteriously, this soul shares in the monad.
The Godhead.
Yes, the Godhead. Of the same nature, of the same material, of the same being in some ways. Sort of a chip off the old block.
In talking about this, it reminds me that how fortunate we are as Catholics to have the church set up by Jesus with Peter as the main shepherd and the rock, and that he who hears you hears me. Most people would never have any time to try to separate the wheat from the chaff in all this religious teaching that's gone on through history. And so I always say it's hard enough to keep the teachings of Jesus, forgive your enemies and do good to those who do evil to you and the like, but not even to know what the teachings of Jesus are and that he is truly God made man, set up a church to teach us. Boy, we would just be a little toy boat on a stormy ocean trying to maintain some kind of religious belief, or we wouldn't have any compass without the church and its teachings. So I think it's good to know that this Gnosticism is seeping constantly, 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 like gas under the doorways through television, magazines, and such things as the Da Vinci Code.
That's true.
All right. Well, can we say a word about salvation? Talked about the soul being good, but the body being bad. What about salvation in the basic understanding of the Gnostics?
Well, the Gnostic has an entirely different conception of salvation than the Christian. Salvation to the Gnostic doesn't come about by redemption as a consequence of the suffering and the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Instead, salvation comes as a result of knowledge of a specific kind achieved through the mediation of a redeemer figure such as Christ, or in some cases, Seth or Sophia. In other words, one attains redemption and salvation by attaining secret knowledge, or gnosis, instead of by faith, prayer, and penance, the sacraments, and good works. According to one Gnostic myth, the redemption begins when the Savior, Christ, returns and lets his female counterpart, Sophia, see the light again, bringing her knowledge of the Spirit. The Greek word, of course, is pneuma. In other words, Christ ignited the divine spark that was already in her. That's why Christ came, in other words. First he comes to Sophia, his counterpart. You see, you have to keep in mind that she went ahead and created without him, the male counterpart.
Okay.
So he the monad, you know, sends him, not the Father, you know, sending the Son, but the monad sends Christ, one of the eons, one of the lowest of the eons now. He sends him to Sophia, his female counterpart, and he gives her this secret knowledge of about this pleroma and all this light and all these things, you know, that we've been talking about. In other words, he tells them the myth. This is her salvation.
Now, a person who has any Christian background, belief and believes in and reads and believes in the Bible, person who certainly is a Catholic who has any kind of reasonable education in his faith, would say all these things are so strange and different from what Revelation teaches us and Jesus teaches us, that why would anybody even worry about it? But what we're trying to say is, this is what is on modern television today, these documentaries, Discovery Channel, and the Historic Channel and National Geographic Channel, and it certainly is the Earth in which the roots of the Da Vinci Code have deeply planted themselves. So we're not just talking head stuff and mythology for mythology's sake. We're talking about things that attack the very basis of our Catholic and Christian faith.
Well, it's a theory of salvation that's diametrically opposed, of course, you know, to the Christian teaching on salvation, that the Father sending the Son into the world to suffer and die and to rise again, you know, to defeat death and to save us. It's an entirely different idea.
Okay, so let's go on a little bit about, we talked about salvation in the Gnostic mythology. What about Christ?
Well, after Christ ignited, keeping in mind now that he is the counterpart to Sophia in this myth, mm-hmm. Sent by the monad to inform her of the things that she didn't know because she'd gotten separated from all of this when she fell, so to speak, from grace. After this spark was reignited in Sophia, then Christ was sent to the earth in the form of a man, Jesus, to give humans the gnosis, that is, the secret knowledge they needed to ignite the divine spark in them, which would enable them to escape the material body in the physical world and return to the spiritual world, the Gnostic version of heaven. Now, as we found out in some of the Gnostic Gospels much earlier, several sessions ago, the Jesus is portrayed in these Gnostic Gospels as not a human being, really. He's really more like a ghost. He's more like a phantom or
a disembodied.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yes,
person. So he's not. He's obviously not God, but and he's not in our sense even a human. Like the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John describe him as being tired and hungry,
yes,
and weary on his journey and thirsty and the like.
Well, the reason that Christ couldn't come into the world and take on human flesh, and then from the Gnostic point of view, is because flesh is evil.
Okay.
And of course, Christ is, he's an aeon. He's the lowest emanation, you know, the lowest level of the Godhead, so to speak, of the monad, but he couldn't take on human, so he only appears to do that.
Okay.
I think it was not Sandra Meisel, but Amy Welburn made something like him putting on a cloak or something of that sort, but not really a human being as such. He just appeared to be a human being.
Okay.
And you see that kind of thing portrayed quite a bit in the Gnostic Gospels. Of Christ. He's just not a real human being.
Now, if a person wanted to read the Gnostic Gospels, they're available in almost any bookstore today.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so it's nothing.
And there, most of them are readily available on the Internet.
Okay.
And Nag Hammadi, for example, there's the whole library is on the Gnostic website. And you can...
So we're not talking about some hidden information that people wouldn't have access to. All they'd have to do is read any of these Gnostic Gospels and see if what we're saying is not correct.
Yes, and one of the best places to start, I suppose, would be with Elaine Pagel's book, you know, on the Gnostic Gospels. The problem is, if you don't know how to interpret it, then it might be a little dangerous to do that. So I wouldn't recommend, you know, someone who's not a scholar and or at least a layperson who's not aware of the things that we've been discussing, to just pick this up and start reading, unless you have an awfully firm faith and a lot of knowledge, you know. Faith.
So if I don't know my faith clearly, then anything somebody says could convince me of the truth.
Well, that's one of the problems of reading the Da Vinci Code. When a lot of the people who pick it up and read it and accept a lot of this stuff at face value, are people who really have not been performed very well, you know, in their faith. And that's been true most, unfortunately,
well, and so many
in the last 25 or 30 years.
So many of the reviewers said, oh, it's impeccable, authentic research. It claims to be authentic, and it's interpretation of art and the Bible and the like. And an ordinary person wouldn't really know whether that stuff is true or not. Okay, so that's one of the reasons we're talking about the Da Vinci Code and its fundamental flawed rooting in Gnosticism or this secret knowledge.
Yes, and I think it must be noted that in Gnosticism, the gospel story of Jesus is considered strictly allegorical. It was simply used as an outer mystery, as it's been called, to introduce one to Gnosis, rather than being literally true in the historical sense. Now, the last step in this whole mythology is that not all humans were capable of receiving this divine light. In other words, Jesus comes into the world, or Christ comes into the world, to give us this secret knowledge. And about, you know, all this stuff, this myth that we've been describing. He comes to tell us about this myth. Not all humans, though, as we said, are not capable of receiving this. And if one doesn't achieve Gnosis, that is, secret knowledge in this life, some versions of Gnosticism taught that one could do so in subsequent lives. In other words, they believed in reincarnation or the transmigration of souls.
In order to have another chance to learn this secret knowledge.
Yes.
Okay.
Only an elite, for the most part, can learn that. So you've got to work yourself up to the elite.
Okay.
And so in summary, most Gnostic versions were esoteric. That is, true knowledge or Gnosis was available to only a few, and it was anti-material, meaning that they viewed the material world, including the body, as evil. And salvation was, you know, being able to get this knowledge and then escape the material body, the soul, and return to the, the light, the region of light.
So it's so completely contrary to what, as Christians and Catholics, we believe, that God becomes man, takes on, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, because the body is not evil. Flesh is not something that is not good and we need to escape from. Jesus comes and then he has the resurrection of the body and reminds us that we too will have the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. Well, one quick question. Doesn't Dan Brown rely on various elements of Gnosticism in his anti-Christian claims in the Da Vinci Code?
Yes, he does. We've already looked at some of his sources, most of which spent a Gnostic interpretation of the life and sayings of Jesus. Brown relies heavily on the work of a tiny minority of radical scholars and other non-scholarly writers, especially feminists, who believe that Gnostic writings reflect the reality of early Christianity. Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel tell us in their The Da Vinci Hoax, let me quote from them, quote, "It is on these works that Brown based his description of what Jesus really taught. These sources should send up red flags right away. They're not one serious work of Christian history in his bibliography. Not a single work of significant New Testament scholarship, or even the standard references volumes that any undergraduate reading up on early Christian history would be expected to use. He doesn't even cite the New Testament itself as a source for early Christian history."
Ron, thank you so much. Our time has run out. May God bless you always and in all ways.
Yes.